Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim.
Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. This week, we have as our guest, Greg Lehman. Greg was actually our first guest on episode one of the podcast, and this is episode 188. This is a two-part conversation that we're going to have with Greg, and he's going to be talking about his experience as a CEO and as a leader and leadership lessons that he's learned. He is a seasoned CEO. Early in his career, he was a president at Taylor University. He has been a CEO at both PE and public companies with revenues ranging from $35 million to $100 million. He has just some great experience of developing strong leadership capability, building teams, and leading strategic growth and creating shareholder value. He's also been on multiple boards, both in public and private companies, and he's got some great thoughts he's going to share. Looking forward to today's conversation with Greg. Well, for those that didn't listen to that first podcast, which I'm sure there's many that are listening now that weren't at that point, but can you give us just a little bit of your story, your career story, and just kind of how you've gotten to where you are today?
Sure. Thank you, Mark, for the opportunity to speak again. I was your first podcast guest, and hopefully not your last now.
But we'll just wrap it up now.
Yeah, bye, everybody. But it's been a very interesting and fulfilling career for me. And as I look back on the career, oftentimes what impacted me and led me to make tough decisions as to what I want to do is having good mentors. And I have been very blessed to have some wonderful mentors along my career path. And in many cases, it has remained the same person. And in other cases, it's been new people that I've gotten to know that have a lot more experience than I have, although I have quite a bit myself. But that's been very impactful for my career path. And so let me give you some examples of that. So I spent 17 years in higher education, former college president, as you may remember. And my mentor was the retired president who was still living next to campus. And he took me under his wing, even though I had a lot of senior leadership positions. I'd never been a college president. But he critiqued my speeches. He critiqued my agenda. And he said, "Now, I'm not going to tell you how to do things. That's your job. But I will guide you and critique what you're planning and to do, and also the strategy you want to deploy for the university." So that was very influential. And I would say that gentleman, his name is Milo Rediger, he probably had the greatest impact on my career of anything. And another gentleman was the president of an insurance company who was on one of my boards. And he was just an absolute gem of a person, but a very tough businessman. And so he took me under his wing as well. What's interesting is both of these gentlemen were about the same age, and they were exactly, you know, if I was 35 years old, they were 70, you know, so double my age. But I just learned so much from both of those gentlemen. So what happened then is, you know, that they taught me how to really onboard in a new position and how to hit the ground running. And they taught me a valuable lesson that I still use to this day. And that is, give yourself at least 60 to 90 days in a new position in the executive, on the executive team, for example. Give yourself 60 to 90 days to really do a deep dive in terms of what does the organization look like. In the interview process, you'll learn a lot, but it's never complete, and in some cases, purposefully not complete. Right. So, and that's looking at whatever the business does, if it's producing goods and services, you want to look at the customer list, the internal operations, the IT infrastructure, you know, the strength of the department heads, and, you know, basically customer interviews to find out how well are we known and how well are we respected in the marketplace. And then I would write up a report to the board of directors and present it. And from that, I was able then to reach a consensus on what is the revised strategy of the business, and do we need a product refresh, rebranding? Do we need a new suite of products to complement the existing suite of products? And the other thing is, if we launch a new product or a service, is it going to cannibalize the one that we have as our legacy product? And so all of those things need to be really discussed in great detail. But having the roadmap, I felt, was better than, you know, flying by the seat of your pants, so to speak. And in many cases, you're tempted to do that because of the tyranny of the urgent. There are brush fires that start every day, and you need to be nimble, know whether you need to take them on or just monitor them and assign them to somebody else to deal with. And there's no yes or no answer. There's no right or wrong answer. It's just, you have to weigh how critical is the situation that's evolving, and how do you need to deal with it? And more importantly, how do you address, you know, if it's an interruption of service, for example, because of a natural disaster, you need to get the word out to your customers, but also be very transparent. So I used those mentoring skills to mentor people that now I'm in touch with that are younger than me, in some cases, half of my age. And I'm honing what those two mentors taught me and teaching them as well, but also helping critique how they're doing and tell them, I'm not a threat to you. I've walked into your moccasins, so I'm just here to help. But I think I mentioned this before, always using the Socratic method when you ask them a question. So that means they can't answer it with yes or no. They need to answer it with an anecdote, or here's what I did and here's why I did it, because then as a mentor coach, you can take them to whatever the epiphany is or the conclusion of what needs to be done. So what was interesting is that I've led higher education institutions. I've worked with private equity as CEO and with public companies as CEO. The expectations are a little different, but at the end, it's all the same. How much money you're going to make me, or how's the business or university going to grow? What do we need to do to stay viable and ahead of the competition? And all of those things play into that. And by doing that, I had a very, very wonderful career that was always a job that was a little tougher than the next one, that somebody found out about me and then called me. I've had executive recruiters such as you call me. And it was just, you know, then I had to make the other hard decision. Do I stay and complete what I started, or do I help find my successor and move on to a new challenge? And again, that's probably for another podcast. How do you make those decisions? But that's really how my career progressed. Primarily outside of higher education, it's been medical device manufacturing and healthcare services. So I've stayed kind of in that lane, and I'm probably still in that lane. But, you know, having worked at a university, I've run a not-for-profit foundation in Washington, D.C. The skills are interchangeable. The outcomes are measured in a different way, but the skill set is transferable to not-for-profit, for-profit, public, and private. There are just different rules and guidelines that you have to abide by.
Hey. Well, we have some exciting news to share. We just recently have asked Greg to join us at our firm to help us out in kind of building out our healthcare and med tech medical device practice and been in that space myself for a number of years recruiting. So we're looking forward to your wisdom as we serve our clients. I need to ask you this question. I didn't ask this in the first podcast, but think back to just your first ever job. What was that? And describe that. I love to hear people's experience early on.
My first ever paying job, and I was offered a job, this job, for 65 cents an hour. So that dates me. Sure. But it was working for a meat canning plant, and they also manufactured sorghum molasses that were sold in grocery stores. I had no idea what I was doing. I was actually 16 years old when I took that job. And so I don't count mowing lawns and, you know, things like that. This was a real job. So I learned how to actually bone out and butchers know this term, bone out a front and hind quarter of beef and be able to cut it into small little squares, put it in a can, seal it, and then drop it into a commercial vat, steam pressure cooker, and cook canned meat. And I learned how to do that, which was amazing. And my wife asked me, why do you have so many scars on your fingers? And I said, well, I cut myself with a boning knife that are very sharp, and they're sharpened every day. But at any rate, that was a great, they gave me a lot of responsibility. And I probably shouldn't say this on a podcast, but it's been so long, nobody cares. At 16 years old, they knew I knew how to drive. And so I took a 3/4 ton truck full of cartons of canned meats around to grocery stores and took the back roads and was never stopped. And learned a lot of things probably that I shouldn't have, but it was a lot of fun. And I actually look forward to the work because I was learning a skill.
Sure. That's that's a great story. And probably most people wouldn't know that's where you began your career. So that's so talk a little bit about executive search, just your experience with it and kind of, we've talked over time and I've always thought it would be fun to work with you and just have appreciated your wisdom and advice over the years. But talk a little bit about that, just your view of the importance of being working with a search firm and what value they can bring.
Right. That's a great question. And that probably will explain a little about why I wanted to work with you and the firm. I've found that it's almost impossible as a leader to, you know, go on job boards or post and find a really genuinely good person for the job. So it has to do more with what their job experience is, as you know, but also finding out more about what personality type they have, how they make decisions, a lot of, you know, what I call indirect items that a lot of people don't think about. And in many cases, the references, as you know, are ones that you hand, the candidate handpicks. And so I always would say, I want to call some people myself who sure. are not on the list that they have worked with. And that was very helpful as well. And in some cases, it sped up the process where I found this person's a great fit. And 99% of the time, they are a great fit. You know, sometimes they, for whatever reason, they don't work. But the firms that I've worked with that I appreciate are the ones that have what I call organizational intelligence. And I think you even use that term. And insights as to what it takes to be a leader, whether it's a COO, a chief technology officer, a chief revenue officer, chief operating officer, or CEO. All of those are different skill sets, but they need to mesh as a team. And I found that, I'm a pretty good judge of people, but I also need an impartial, deeper dive by somebody in an organization that can address points that I would never be able to uncover. And that was worth every dollar that I paid in terms of the search fees, and it produced really great, solid candidates. And in many cases, there were more than one I could choose from. It's just a matter of, you know, your gut, what's the right fit, but they're all qualified. So, and the other thing is, I like a search firm who I can partner with for more than just one position, one that knows the organization, one that understands what's working, what needs to be cleaned up. Do you have the right people in the right position? And so I don't like the one and done approach. I like to be a long-term customer of a search firm to handle all my needs as the business continues to evolve and hopefully grow.
Great. You've had a lot of experience sitting on the other side of the desk and hiring people, and you've sat on both public and private boards. Over your career, what was one of the most difficult lessons that you've learned in the different positions that you've been in? Talk a little bit about that.
One of the most challenging for me was working, providing diabetes inpatient and outpatient care for an organization where I was the chief revenue officer. And the reason I say that it was very difficult, the model of how the company performed these services and built out the, in some cases, a mobile diagnostic unit. And, they had to have podiatrists or physicians on board to treat diabetic ulcers and different maladies that these people had. But due to that complexity, what I struggled with in that job more than anything is I had a boss that was local where I worked, and his boss was part of a larger conglomerate on the West Coast. And oftentimes I would get conflicting signals from my boss's boss versus what my boss wanted to be done. And it put me in a very awkward position because I wasn't sure what to tell my boss if I had a directive from his boss. And so how we worked it out was I would have a monthly call with the president, my boss, and me, and his boss once a month. And that solved that problem where we, and my boss then became more comfortable. He was thinking that you're being groomed to take my job, and I don't like that. So that was a tough lesson to learn. And then I think what made it even more interesting was the hospitals were very jealous of their square footage, and they don't want to give any up. This was during a time when hospital beds were pretty full. They didn't want to give up space for a diabetic clinic if that wasn't something that was in their sweet spot in terms of having the staff and the team to do it like a center of excellence. So I was fighting those battles, one of them personality battles and chain of command battles, and one of them getting sales to close. And it was a long sales cycle, almost 18 months. So by far the toughest job, the most challenging relationally speaking and operationally speaking of anything I've ever done.
So where was your first team that you led? What position was that? And describe kind of what you went through as far as transitioning from that more of an individual contributor to a leader of a team. Talk a little bit about that experience.
My first team that I actually led was right out of my undergraduate school. And I was a chief bursar for a regional campus of a very large state university. And a bursar is the one that, gets to collect the tuition and the fees. And so the team I inherited were all above 60 years of age, and I was 21.
Wow.
And so there was an interesting dynamic that I inherited, and I had one older woman come up to me and say, "Greg, you have no idea what you're walking into, and I am here to help you, but if you mess up, I'll make sure you get fired." So that was my first team meeting. And I thought, okay, I have a lot of work to do, but eventually I won them over. But as the years progressed, my age was a little more mature, had a little more gray hair, which helps. And I gained some credibility. That was a tough one. And I, as a result of that job, and I think the success that I had, I ended up applying and getting a fellowship to Purdue University, all expenses paid, to get my master's and PhD. And it was all because I was known by them and sponsored by the chief financial officer at Purdue University, as he was my reference. So it worked out really well.
That's great. We want to talk a little bit about just your work with private equity. There are a number of new leaders or new CEOs that maybe have never worked with venture capital or private equity, and you've worked with a number of different private equity firms over the years. Talk about just the importance, and I know I read one of your papers that talked about value creation and in that relationship with the private equity. What are some things that you've learned?
Yeah, thank you. That's a topic near and dear to my heart. I will preface the paper. I actually was asked by a private equity firm out west to write this paper because they use it as a training document for some of their newer CEOs. But I will say this, having run, you know, four PE-backed companies as CEO and then two public companies as CEO, value creation is top of the list for any of those entities. However, even though you're running a public company, the difference is you have to deliver quarterly results and get critiqued by that. And creating value means getting the stock price to go up, which means you got to grow revenue and profitability. Private equity is different. They still are critically involved in making sure you understand, as a new CEO, how they expect to create value. And usually it's whatever they paid for the business they want you to run. They want a multiple of that 5 to 7 years down the road. And you're judged monthly, and in some cases, biweekly, a couple of times a month through calls. So the conundrum that you're faced as a new CEO is the private equity fund, and they all do this. They tell you what their expectations are, how much they expect you to grow the business every year, what type of free cash flow can you generate in order to pay down debt that they put on the business that maybe wasn't there before. And that's how they judge creating value. And they always end that by saying, "You make us money, you and your team will make money. You don't, we don't get anything, and you don't either." So it's a risk reward ratio that you have to be addressing. What I think the biggest challenge is, Mark, is oftentimes when you get into the business, you find things out, as I said in a few minutes ago, you find out things that you weren't told in the interview. Even if they're thinking of buying a company and you see the confidential information memorandum, the SIM as they call it, you look at that and you say, "Oh, this is a great business. It's growing by leaps and bounds and there are no issues." The first day you walk in, there are operational issues. There is a culture that you're not part of, so you're viewed as the enemy. And in some cases, there's skepticism. especially if somebody in the executive team thought they were going to get promoted to your job. And that happens in many cases. But there are brush fires all over the place. And what you need to do is not only just address them, but you need to share those with your private equity partners, whoever is on the board. And usually private equity dominates the board of a privately held company. But as an operator, I found out that if I spend all my time just creating value, we're not going to be able to grow efficiently and effectively and profitably because the infrastructure is weak. And secondly, the way to get to value creation is often not aligned. And so the work is develop the strategy, what needs to be done. A lot of new CEOs try to do everything at one time. I call it boiling the ocean. And they're setting themselves up for failure. And if the private equity partner feels that you're not doing the right thing at the right time to create the value, in many cases, they will start to micromanage. So, you know, we can talk a little bit more about what that takes, but I found when I was asked to write this paper, I went back through probably six different private equity funds that I've worked with and kind of jotted down what did I do to help create value and what was the sequence. And so I found out if I can help young CEOs, particularly if a firm comes to executive search and says, hey, I got to find a CEO. I don't know enough people that have this in their background. Can you help me out? And so in many cases, that's the path that they take. Very few have internal candidates. In some cases, if it's a founder-led company, they're asked to stay on the board, but they may want some liquidity and cash out some of their equity and then sit on the board, which creates another dynamic for the new CEO because you've got the former CEO critiquing every move you make. So there are ways to circumvent that. But in the end, if you don't have a partnership that has transparency and open communication, there will be a lot of combative moments between the private equity fund and the CEO. And it's an art as much as a science, Mark. And that's where I think I could help some people looking for CEOs, looking for C-suite people, but not knowing how to go about it. But finding out, you know, have they done this before? Do they have the secret sauce, the formula, and then be able to train others to do the same thing?
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader. Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.